ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
If fuel were to stop flowing to Australia, how long do you reckon we could last?
As the war in the Middle East deepens, it's the sort of question you might find yourself asking.
So, how vulnerable are we really when it comes to fuel or anything else for that matter? What really happens when the next big shock hits?
I'm Kylie Morris.
I'm Hamish McDonald. This is Global Roaming, and the first episode in a new series we're running this week, The World Reordered. So, Kylie, how often do you find yourself answering questions from friends or family, and they say, why doesn't Australia just cast adrift from the United States? Trump, it's so crazy, so hard to manage. Why don't we just do our own thing?
Increasingly so. I think as Trump engages ever more vigorously with the world in a way that we can't predict or we wouldn't necessarily vote for.
And so how do you answer when someone says that?
I say that I think we still have choices to make, right? I think we have policies, we have institutions, we have our own government. If you don't like the way that politicians are guiding Australia's foreign policy, then think about who you vote for. Because I do think we have levers of control in our own reach, even though sometimes it feels as though we don't.
I think something that has been a recurring feature of all the correspondence we've received ever since Global Roaming began is the degree to which it's on the minds of Australians where we sit in the world. And that's only becoming more acute as the world gets more chaotic. At the moment, it's the fuel shortage question, the 30, 40 days that Australia has in its fuel reserves, discussion in the daily news cycle right now about the possibility of fuel rationing. That's just one dimension of this incredibly complex puzzle of the interconnectedness we have that we rely on as part of a kind of global supply chain, not to mention the really pointy end security dimensions.
That's true. That's all true. But at the same time, I think there are cultural relationships that we have, right, that underpin and in some ways complicate those security relationships.
Well, this argument that we have alliances because we share values, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've stood alongside the United States for a long time. Now, that doesn't mean that it necessarily should continue, but there is a kind of a lag, I think, in terms of thinking about it in purely pragmatic terms versus the kind of cultural weight we bring to that relationship.
The conventional wisdom, though, when you speak to whether it's the foreign policy crowd or the military strategic national security crowd, the conventional wisdom is, well, you can't just unlatch yourself from a major alliance. Our entire security architecture, military architecture, is based around this notion of the ANZUS alliance. Our broader security arrangements are under AUKUS with the UK as well, and that if you just cast yourself adrift, you then have a whole drop-down menu of other questions that come into play, like the proportion of GDP, for example, that you're spending on your defence. Who do you work with? Who would you be prepared to go to war against? What the value of your other relationships is. And so it's not as simple as just saying, Trump's made us question everything, let's go our own way.
But enter Mark Carney, who gives that barnstorming speech about middle powers, right? And about the idea that we can exercise some independent thinking even when in a time of great power rivalry, and even when, I mean, in Canada's case, their near neighbour is the United States, and the shadow of Washington looms very large in terms of their economy, their way of thinking, their future.
But I've heard a lot of reaction within the kind of political establishment in Australia that's quite dismissive of Carney, that fundamentally it's a bit naive to think you can just go your own way, having been reliant on great and powerful friends for so long. We know, and thank you for all of the correspondence, that this idea, this notion of a plan B is something that plays on the minds of so many Australians. And that's why we've decided to use this week to start interrogating that, exploring that, hearing from some really valuable voices, thoughtful voices, beginning today, that are contending with this question. What does Australia do if not rely on the United States and its traditional alliances? What most worries us? How could we respond to those challenges in a more complicated, great power competition-based world where Australia sits at the nexus of those great powers, both geographically, trade, foreign policy-wise? What do we do? So we're beginning this series with Rory Metcalf. He's the director of the National Security College at ANU, and they've just conducted and they're releasing this week the results of an enormous piece of work that's taken place over the last couple of years. 12,000 Australians surveyed, focus groups, 500 interviews, physically travelling across the nation to engage not just with the establishment, but with remote regional communities, urban communities, about what it is that worries Australians and where they think the solutions might lie. Here he is now.
Rory Metcalf, welcome to Global Roaming.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Can I start? You have done a lot of work, your organisation, on this report, highlighting, I guess, where Australians' concerns sit when it comes to national security. And one of the things that it seems they are focused on, as are you, is critical systems. So things like our energy, water, fuel supplies. How vulnerable is Australia feeling right now?
The data we have shows that the community does feel vulnerable, I think very vulnerable in some instances. And they've also got really a high level of sophistication in understanding what the threats and the risks are. And a lot of them are to do with really the continuity of normal life. So it's critical infrastructure, it's connectivity, it's systems of water and transport and energy, particularly in rural and remote parts of Australia. It's threats to society, disinformation, cohesion. It's threats from technologies, cyber, AI, and it's really how all of these cohere. So, look, it is a pretty confronting picture that this data shows, but at the same time, this is the knowledge that I think is the first step towards a national conversation, a first step towards, I think, more informed and confident engagement from our political class to do something about this.
What was the point of this project that you've embarked on, Rory? I guess set the scene for listeners about what you're trying to achieve.
Well, as research, this is really trying to understand what Australians think about the whole raft of security risks that the nation and the world faces. There's a very pointed policy purpose to doing this, and that is that as a security analyst myself, I've been concerned for a long time that the nation is not focused enough on national preparedness. There is a world of risk out there. Of course, we shouldn't be panicking about it. It's not all doom and gloom. But we are certainly beyond an age where we can assume that everything's going to be all right, and where we can assume that great and powerful friends will look after us, and where we can assume those of us who work, particularly in Canberra, in the security community, whether it's the bureaucracy or academia or think tanks or security agencies, we shouldn't assume that somehow we have all the answers, and that the community of this extraordinarily diverse and dispersed country will get with the program if a shock and a crisis comes.
There's always a risk, I guess, with a conversation like this, is that there's a gap between perception and reality. And sometimes the politicians, even the security leaders, will say to us, don't be too scared, don't panic. And we're hearing that at the moment with the fuel. But where have you been? Who have you heard from? And what do they tell you worries them?
So a starting point is precisely what you've said, don't panic. And, you know, in my view, panic often comes from being misinformed, not from being informed. Having said that, you know, there were parts of the population who we engaged with who did acknowledge that too much release of information by government could cause panic. And some people trust, particularly the security agencies, whether it's ASIO or the Federal Police or others, to release information as necessary, but to manage the problems. But I think the bigger question is about the signalling and the communication from government at a political level, at an executive level, across parliament, because if there is indeed a gap not only between perception and reality, but a gap between what the government knows and what the public thinks, or what the public thinks it knows. You know, that gap could become a real problem if we do need to pull together as a country to deal with circumstances and risks in the future, particularly doing so as a democracy where the consent of the population, the informed consent of the population, is key to sustainable policy.
Rory, you say the message is don't panic. Are we panicking? I mean, do public perceptions of Australia's vulnerability match what the actual risks are?
There is no simple answer to that. And look, I came away from this project with a very refreshed sense of the common sense of most of the community on most issues, to be honest. And I think there is a rounded and mature recognition that not everything is a crisis, but that in this different world where everything's connected, where economic or information shocks or technology shocks overseas are having immediate impacts in Australia, where we've also got the challenge of building and maintaining cohesion in this incredibly diverse, vibrant democratic society that we have, this is now a set of circumstances where there are going to be cascading impacts of something going wrong. And I think the policy challenge is how can government prepare the community in ways that it can maintain confidence and cohesion during crises. And I think the message out of all of this is to say more of the community, I think, is more ready for a national conversation on these issues than a risk-averse culture in government tends to realise. And that risk-averse culture is something that's developed over the last few decades. I don't hold this at the door of the current government any more than at the door of previous governments. But it's a culture in our system where there's only so much information that is released. And even officials who do hold, I think, understandable concerns about the need for national preparedness are only able to communicate about that publicly with political cover. The more we can get a confidence in government and a confidence in parliament that it's okay to talk about risk with the community, and that the community response to that, if it's done properly, isn't necessarily going to be panic, but could actually be reassurance. I think that's the starting point that this data suggests.
So that is so interesting, Rory, because I reckon, you know, as a journalist, we're constantly frustrated by the gap between the conversations we might be able to have with political leaders or bureaucrats or intelligence leaders and what they're willing and able to say in public. And yet, I suppose something we've learned even just through this program over the last few years is not just the appetite for understanding and knowledge, but the sophistication and maturity with which Australians right across the landscape are engaging with these issues. So how do you change that culture? How do you shift what our leaders are willing and able to talk about?
So I think we're trying to prove with numbers what you've just said. And to be absolutely clear, we set out with some hypotheses about public willingness to engage on these issues, and we were surprised by some of the results. This isn't all, you know, a confirmation of what we suspected. To be honest, I think that the awareness and the complexity and the resilience of a lot of the public understanding on these issues is actually better than we expected. You know, people are informed, they may not always be informed enough, and there may be, you know, a high degree of anxiety. There is a high degree of anxiety. But I think there's also a recognition that a lot of issues that are not traditionally called security, you know, whether it's disinformation in the community, whether it's violent unrest in the community, whether it's issues to do with technology or crime or social trust, these are all just as important, probably more important to the continuity of daily life and confidence in being Australian than the military issues. But the military issues still matter. And there was also, I think, a clear understanding that while military threats to Australia have less likelihood, significantly less probability than these other issues, consequences of something like that happening would be catastrophic. You know, effectively, we gave the community a matrix, the sort of matrix that intelligence agencies use to assess risk and probability. And the answers were very, very clear. People think about this.
You're with Kylie Morris and Hamish McDonald on Global Roaming on ABC Radio National. And we're joined by the director of the ANU's National Security College, Rory Metcalf.
There's an intrinsic or an inherent challenge, though, with security and intelligence issues? Like, I often think about the AUKUS rollout, however you want to describe that announcement. You know, it was all done in secret. We kind of understand the reasons why, because there was another deal that had to be ditched. There was enormous money at stake as well as geopolitical interests. And yet we're still dealing with the fact that the public wasn't really brought along in that conversation, and still there's large swathes of the community entirely unconvinced about this enormous strategic bet that Australia's taken.
You know, I actually see the strategic logic of, you know, the kinds of submarines that AUKUS is about for Australia's geography, you know, the stealth, the range and all of that. But at the same time, I think the AUKUS rollout was, you know, a model of how not to do social license. And we still haven't resolved that problem of true social license for AUKUS. I think a lot of the population do understand that we need serious military capabilities. They do understand, you know, like it or not, that we have this alliance with the United States. And I think they even understand that there are strategic risks of war in the region. But at the same time, I think the campaign to explain AUKUS to the population has been pretty disappointing. And this data suggests that there is a public that is more open to the contestability of that conversation, whichever way it goes.
Rory, in part of the survey from February, I think the four highest concerns in the community that your survey discovered were cyber threats, firstly, violent extremism targeting part of the community, a world in which no rules stop strong states, and terror attacks. And that's a list informed, of course, by the Bondi attacks on the Jewish community in Sydney. But that concern about a world in which no rules stop strong states, how does that intersect with the Australian-American alliance?
The piece about the international order is really important. And I think the fact that we put in a question which is code for the failure of the rules-based order, in other words, a world where no rules constrain strong states from doing what they want, that also had more than 70% levels of concern perceived as either a major or moderate threat to Australia. And again, I think that points to a strong understanding of how Australia is connected to the international system and how what happens in the world will affect us. We can't hide from that. And that could be the behaviour of our ally, or it could be the behaviour of China or another authoritarian power. So just for sort of listeners' benefit, the rating of 70% or more of something being perceived as a serious threat, a moderate or major threat, that rating touches many of the things we introduced, but most of them are much more domestic in focus, you know, the impact on critical infrastructure or supply chains of disinformation. The breakdown of the rules-based order is the big international one, and that was rated more highly than military conflict, even though that's obviously one of the consequences of it.
Did you find an awareness of the importance of social cohesion to national security?
Oh, massively. I think nobody would wish for an atrocity like the Bondi terrorist attack to occur at any time. But the fact that we had that incident, we had that national trauma occur during the 18 months or so of our research, and that we saw in real time how that actually changed the results, heightened concern about social cohesion, heightened concern about polarisation, heightened concern about disinformation and terrorism. You know, the only silver lining I would take out of that is to say that the public can be motivated by real threats and real risks, and that there is, if you like, a latent sense of civic responsibility. We asked a question in the aftermath of the Bondi attack in our February survey that, you know, in the wake of that atrocity, do you think, or to what extent do you think all Australians have a responsibility for ensuring safe and peaceful communities? We got a 71% yes. I would have liked it to have been a little bit higher, but we only got an 8% no. I'm a little bit astounded what the 8% no were thinking, but nonetheless, we've got to acknowledge that all the responses to our surveys are legitimately expressed views of parts of the Australian public. But a 71% yes, and a 32% of that strongly agreed that all Australians hold a responsibility to ensure safe and peaceful communities. That's actually a strong starting point, again, in this extraordinarily diverse and dispersed country. And I think everywhere, whether it's from rural areas to some of the urban centres we went to, we spent quite a lot of time in Western Sydney, for example, talking with multicultural community figures there, we recognise that I guess the sense of trust and cohesion in society when things go wrong is the vital glue. And even interestingly, I was listening to a speech the other day by the chief of the Air Force of all people, you know, even military leaders in this country recognise that without the support of the people, military capability is nothing.
Rory, you say that this is the starting point, as you hope it will become a broader, deeper national conversation. Who carries and drives that? Like, my sense is there's maybe a fairly shallow pool of people who have been the ones to have this conversation in Australia to date, often probably from quite similar backgrounds. Is there a plan, is there a pathway in your mind that would see this become a more dynamic conversation?
Just to track back on that a little bit, I mean, I've been working in so-called national security for a long time, and I've always had this sort of awkward feeling that a lot of the community do see national security as a bit of a dirty word. It's not something that, particularly if you're from the progressive side of politics, you know, you especially want to get involved in. It's sometimes seen to be, you know, overreacting or threatening freedoms or other good things in life. But in having this conversation around the country, we've also recognised that even though a lot of the community don't necessarily call it security, and that's probably a good thing, they call it safety, resilience, cohesion, that there is a strong appetite at different levels of the community for a more confident and informed conversation about how we maintain the continuity of normal life in this country, where we are still very, very fortunate. And we're fortunate to have the, I guess, the opportunities of being in Australia. So we found a positive appetite for a multi-layered conversation about the resilience, security, confident future of the nation, often from parts of the community who don't normally feel even invited into the security conversation. So there's a gender piece there. There's also a piece to do with, you know, socioeconomics, with, you know, levels of income, education, where you live, obviously, in many cases, what migrant background you might be from as well. So I think there are large parts of the population who felt that the official national security conversation coming out of government is not about them, and that they don't have a contribution to make. And often it's done, of course, in either jargon or sort of politically careful language. It's often in language that is quite alienating. I think the missing link here is political representatives. So if you said, where do we go from here? You know, are we realistically going to see much more open dialogue and consultation between national security bureaucrats or practitioners or officials or spies or the military or whoever it might be with the ordinary community? Well, actually, I think a lot of them would quite like that. A lot of the people who are professionals working in this space would be quite open about much more direct engagement with the community. But the political license has to be there. And as I said, I think historically we've had a very risk-averse political culture, which has only become more risk-averse over time. So there needs to be a kind of a greater political confidence to let the practitioners engage with broader parts of the community. And that also brings with it, I think, a higher degree of responsibility for political representatives across the political spectrum to resist the temptation for partisan exploitation of every national security issue, whichever side of politics they come from, to focus on helping to inform their own constituencies. And that's where I think having a more informed federal parliament, but also bringing state and territory parliamentarians, you know, mayors into the conversation, the voices who are not normally brought into national security, but once you say to them, what are you concerned about, as we did in the consultations, and what do you think we could do about it, after initial hesitation, you find a strong willingness to be part of the solution. And I would be fine if, you know, a few years from now, we're not even talking about national security, we're talking about resilience or, you know, national confidence or a ready Australia. That's fine. But I think joining those dots is where, at this stage, political leadership has been too cautious.
Rory, thank you so much.
Thank you again, Kylie. Thanks, Hamish.
Thanks, Rory. And I should just acknowledge, to be totally upfront and clear, I do have a role with the National Security College. Latika does too, by the way. It's very interesting work, but I do have an affiliation there. Well, Kylie, your takeaway from that conversation with Rory Metcalf?
It's interesting to me to hear a national security professional prioritising matters like social cohesion and social license and the need for political leadership not to be risk averse. I mean, that's a very different kind of conversation than you would have struck even 5-10 years ago, certainly in Australia. So I found it really interesting what it revealed, or what it has revealed, of the Australian community's view on these subjects. You know, the fact that there's a prioritisation of a disordered or an unordered world and big states not having to adhere to any rules, but also cybersecurity and, of course, disinformation and misinformation. I think that's, I find that all fascinating.
I did participate in some of the sessions, and it was really fascinating actually to sit in rooms with people who are not necessarily national security people talking about these issues that fold into that broader kind of area of thought. And I think what is true is that the meta narrative, the big narrative that sits above us all, is about the changing state of the world, not just the great power politics, but the kind of mass disruption that the planet is going through at the moment. And so that plays on everyone's minds. And I think for me anyway, that's the really significant thing about the piece of work that Rory and his colleagues have undertaken, is that it does try to burst the bubble of the national security conversation in terms of who has it and how they have it, and try and see what the linkages are between the broader population. You know, the people that are buying additional jerry cans full of fuel at the moment, and the people that make the decisions about whether Australia contributes a wedge-tail aircraft to go to the Gulf and assist in the response to the Iran conflict. That's the kind of, that's the bit for me that's quite fascinating.
And also that question of what are we talking about really when we talk about national security? We're not only talking about how big our army is or how, you know, fast our aircraft are, but we're also talking about what is it that we want to protect? How much can we depend upon one another? How much do we trust our allies?
Well, also, would we be Ukraine if we came under attack? Would we all come together? Would we all sign up? Would we all contribute? How would we do that? And how would Australia defend itself? How would we act if this situation in the Middle East gets worse, if it spirals, if global fuel supplies become an entrenched issue? How would we respond? I think that's the sort of thing that we don't quite have answers for. So, Kylie, the really good news is that we're going to continue this conversation about Australia's place in a more chaotic world throughout this week on Global Roaming. What's next?
Well, next is a conversation between Geraldine and Latika with Michael Wesley. He's written a quarterly essay called Blind Spot, and it's about, I guess, his thesis that Australia has neglected to build the relationship that is the relationship we should have with Southeast Asia. And in fact, we've let those relationships with neighbouring countries in the region slide. And he talks about the politics behind that. He talks about the room for communities to build connections across borders. It's a great conversation. So that's on the next episode.
And David Kilcullen by the end of the week. And don't forget, we're running a mini-series on the matter of facts as well, the post-truth world, disinformation. Our first episode dropped yesterday. There'll be another one next Monday. Thanks to our producers on this episode, Aston Brown and Shane Anderson. Kylie, I'll see you next time.
Cheers, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.